This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is January 30th, 2025. Just a little over 16 years ago, that's January 3rd, 2009 to be exact, the first Bitcoin was mined, giving birth to a new class of investments known as digital assets. And while adolescence can be a tricky time, 2024 was a standout year for digital asset ETFs in particular. And as our guests today explain, there are real reasons that institutional investors have started to pay more attention. But what exactly do we mean when we say digital assets? For that, we turn to our first guest.
Hi, this is Padmakar Kulkarni. I'm part of Index Research Organization at MSCI. So digital assets, in simple terms, refer to assets that exist in a digital form and are typically represented or issued using advanced technologies such as blockchain or more broadly distributed ledger technology. The typical digital assets are in the form of a medium of exchange or cryptocurrencies as we know them, but they are also in the form of tokenized assets or tokens to represent the real world assets, products or services. And then there is a certain category called NFTs, the non-fungible tokens.
So, okay, I appreciate that explanation. You introduced a couple of other terms there, though, that, again, I just want to make sure we define our terms, so to speak. So you said blockchain and you said NFTs. Can you give us a little description of both of those?
Blockchain is a technology used to basically execute and validate the trades that happen using digital assets. This is positioned as something which doesn't require an intermediary, and this creates immutable records, and that way it's a robust technology and can work across geographies and across time zones without requiring any interference from third party as we have in current financial markets.
Old school perspectives listeners may recall that we discussed NFTs a few years ago when there were a lot of people selling digitally based art as well as other items. Now, there was a lot of skepticism around it, but our guest at the time explained that it was also a bit of a proving ground for online ownership. Or, as Padmakar put it, NFTs.
You can say a tokenized assets. So something like a painting or a music component, which has been saved or stored in the digital form, which can then be used to trade.
But of course, the first and maybe even the last thing that people think about when they hear the term digital assets is cryptocurrencies and specifically Bitcoin. But as we'll hear from our guests today, there are not only many new cryptocurrencies, but also other ways that the underlying technology, the blockchain, is being used to create new potential opportunities for investors. But for now, let's get back to crypto and the current state of adoption in that part of the market.
If we look at the overall digital asset topic, we can see that adoption is varying in cryptocurrencies, right, at the most adopted use case of digital assets today.
That's our second guest.
My name is Barbara Schlüter. I work at DWS, which is a large asset manager, specifically our Xtrackers franchise, where I'm responsible for our digital products and partnerships. On the 3rd of January 2009, the Bitcoin Genesis block being mined. And since then, the asset class has really developed considerably and adoption has grown. I think the easiest way to look at this is by looking just the amount of wallets. So wallets are blockchain accounts, if you want it that way, that exist that have a non-zero balance. Current statistics show us that there's around 400 million crypto wallets with a non-zero balance. That's not a perfect adoption statistic because one user might have multiple wallets or one wallet might be associated with multiple investors. But nonetheless, right, 400 million crypto wallets. Now look at different regions. What we see from the data is that in particular, lower and middle income countries consistently rank very high in cryptocurrency and also in particular stablecoin adoption. And the question is, why is that the case, right? Why are these countries consistently ranking high?
That is definitely the question. And I'm particularly curious, given a fact that's always stuck with me about how lower and middle income countries, emerging markets if you will, were faster to adapt mobile phones than developed markets. If I remember correctly, the reason was that for many, there was little to no landline infrastructure. In other words, there were no old habits to break. In any case, you and I will both have to be patient. I promise we will get back to Barbara's answer in terms of cryptocurrencies. For now, let's stick with the general topic. And for that, we bring in our third guest.
My name is Shubin. I am the Chief Investment Officer at Manaya Asset Management. Manaya is an investment firm focused on cryptocurrency investments. Bitcoin is the largest asset and one of the oldest in the space, and it gets rightfully a lot of the attention. But there is an entire separate universe that is really exciting that hasn't gotten as much attention, and we think where a lot of the interesting things are happening. Bitcoin was launched in 2009, so it's been around with us for 16 years, kind of operating a block every 10 minutes, 24/7. Around 2015, the idea grew that Bitcoin's a great store of value and viewed as digital gold, but the blockchain technology can be used for a lot more. So names like Ethereum came about, and they started supporting applications where you could do a lot more. Those applications really started around 2015 to 2018 and actually launched in user-friendly ways around 2020. We saw a lot of interest and activity around 2020, 2021, and the interest and activity showed some of the weaknesses in the underlying scalability. So as a lot of users onboarded, prices went up, some of the institutions were less able to handle it. So we saw a little bit of cooling off. And over the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of building in that space where newer solutions continue to grow. The underlying infrastructure is a lot better. The underlying institutions are a lot stronger. As just as we're starting to see a regulatory shift in the US where a lot more users, institutions, governments, everybody's starting to get interested. And we're finding that the space is a lot more ready to and able to handle that volume.
And what has adoption looked like for investors?
If we compare ETP adoption across the globe, we see that crypto ETPs in Europe have existed for many years. The first crypto ETPs in Europe were launched in 2015. We have a well-established market today with more than 200 live products. Total assets under management stand around $20 billion. There's many different coins, not just Bitcoin and Ethereum, but also smaller coins that these products provide access to. And we see both retail as well as institutional investors in various different European countries investing into these assets. In the US, on the contrary, it has been quite different, right? In the US, prior to January 2024, we didn't have a spot Bitcoin ETF or a spot crypto ETF in general. The SEC had been rejecting such products for quite a number of years. And what we saw then in 2024 is after approving these products in January, there was a very steep adoption growth in the US for cryptocurrencies because suddenly access was easier, enabled by regulation to get access to this asset class.
So digital assets ETFs saw remarkable growth in their total asset under management in last year, in 2024. In my view, the regulatory clarity was one of the key catalysts for that. In the United States and other major markets, the approval of spot Bitcoin ETFs and other digital assets ETFs, that kind of reduced barriers for institutional and retail investors. That provided some sort of legitimacy that investors were probably looking for a long time and helped to increase confidence of institutional asset owners, such as pension funds, endowments, to allocate to these assets as a way to diversify. In addition, it may indicate to the investors that the liquidity and accessibility to this asset class is now on the rise.
We may be getting a bit ahead of ourselves here, so this seems like as good a time as any to get back to Barbara's point about the higher numbers for adoption in low and middle income countries and why that's the case.
I would say it is because cryptocurrencies and stablecoins and digital assets generally they address specific pain points that these countries may be facing. One would be cross-border remittances, right? We know that for some cross-border remittances, the statistics show that they are still relatively expensive and also take quite a lot of time in the traditional financial system. So this is a use case where the traditional financial system might have frictions, might have inefficiencies. And stablecoins are one option of how this use case can be addressed and how potentially such cross-border remittances can be made quicker and can be made especially with lower transaction costs. Another argument is access. In some of these emerging economies where we see crypto adoption to be relatively high, there's at the same time statistics that financial inclusion might be on the lower end, where some people might lack access to the traditional financial system. And crypto supporters, they argue, right, it might be easier for some of these people to get access to the crypto and digital asset ecosystem, because to open up a wallet, you just need internet access. A third example might be the store of value argument. It could be that these countries are also generally countries that have historically had higher inflations. And then there are certain cryptocurrencies, and in particular Bitcoin, where we know that the scarce supply is really a key feature. Bitcoin has a known issuance schedule and therefore an associated low inflation rate and a known inflation rate as well. Of course, what's important here to consider is that cryptocurrencies come with these benefits, but they come also with very high risks. And that for these countries, it is, of course, also very important to consider the risks, for example, the heightened volatility.
Frankly, I'm a little surprised it took us this long to even get to the question of volatility. Shubin?
It's certainly important to consider, but as with a lot of things in the cryptocurrency space, the perception and reality are a little bit wider than one would hope they would be. The reality of the space has been that volatility for some of these names has been coming down. So, for example, the volatility on Bitcoin is less than the volatility on a Tesla or an Nvidia. Some of the perceptions about tremendous volatility is a little less true today than it had been, say, 5 to 10 years ago. The other part of it is that it is very much geared towards sizing the solution. So the asymmetry of risk return of a 1 or 2% allocation to the space makes it very, very worthwhile.
That is, of course, that it makes it very, very worthwhile to consider. Please go on.
So the incremental risk that you're taking on that 1 to 2% allocation is far smaller. So Bitcoin, for example, has had annual returns over the last decade of about 80% a year. That kind of return profile has meaningful impact on the returns, but fairly modest impact on the volatility. And the way you get 80% a year returns over time is very much a function of a young asset class that is growing rapidly. 20, 30 years from now, I'm sure the volatility of the space will be much lower and we'll be seeing much less exciting activity happening. This is a 3.7 trillion asset class. You are starting to see, between debt and equity globally, a very, very conservative estimate is 250 trillion. So if we're talking about, forget 5%, 1% coming in, that's $2.5 trillion of assets being allocated to a small asset class where the vast majority of holders are unwilling to sell. So Bitcoin, less than a third has been transacted within the last year. Two-thirds of holders continue to hold. So when you see that kind of money come into the space, that's what attributes to the upside momentum as well as the return asymmetry.
The volatility of Bitcoin is still today 4 to 5 times higher of those of global equities. So still very elevated volatility in terms of, you know, traditional assets. But it has been steadily coming down over the last couple of years. And I think the major driver for this is the increasing institutional integration of cryptocurrency.
Did you catch what Barbara said just now about increasing institutional integration? Most financial innovations begin with institutional investors. But institutional investors are a relatively recent entry to this space. The first 16 years of digital assets history has largely been about retail investors. I asked each of our guests about this.
The push to digital assets really came from retail investors to begin with. And so that is something which triggered curiosity or interest among other market participants. However, there were certain doubts in terms of what is the intrinsic value of this asset class and volatility associated with it, the concentration in the market, and also lack of regulation and governance. So that was something which was keeping institutional investors slightly away from this market or a bit skeptical about allocating to this asset class. But as I said, with more regulatory oversight coming in and having pretty well-known investment vehicles like ETFs available to get exposure to this market.
And that interest has driven change because institutional investors
are looking for investment vehicles that offer better control on this risk and strategies that could help diversify some of this risk away. Digital assets have often exhibited either low or negative correlations with traditional assets such as stocks, bonds, and other commodities. So adding them in a multi-asset class portfolio can make them effective diversifiers. We know that there are risks associated with a digital asset in general, but it is also true that these assets have offered outsized returns historically. We had done some analysis at our end using a simulator portfolio where we added 2% and 5% allocation to digital assets in a traditional 60-40 portfolio. So what we observed was that the risk-adjusted returns of the resultant portfolio, that could be quite appealing to the investors. Bitcoin has traditionally been positioned as digital gold and has also been seen to be working as a hedge against inflation risk. So overall, a small allocation to digital assets to the range of, say, 1% to 5%, that could be seen to enhance risk-adjusted returns.
In addition,
this has led to the emergence of strategies like options overlay, where the Bitcoin investment is combined with covered call options or protective put options with the aim of mitigating downside risks and also to enhance returns wherever possible. These are some of the strategies which are prevalent in the market in other asset classes. So there is nothing new about them, but it's more about combining them with the digital assets as an asset class. And then multi-coin basket allows participation of altcoins. Now, altcoins are the coins other than Bitcoin in investment portfolio, and it helps to diversify. So emergence of these strategies is making digital assets more palatable to institutional investors.
The nature of institutional involvement has increased very, very significantly and is at various points in the spectrum. So you have folks like BlackRock introducing products. So you have ETFs, as well as BlackRock has, if you wanted to invest in a BlackRock treasury fund, previously you could do it through them. Now BlackRock has on-chain treasury funds. Then there are banks that are doing both the, for example, UBS issued bonds on-chain. And folks like Morgan Stanley are going and telling their 15,000 financial advisor base, now, all right, this is an interesting asset class that you can now go and talk to your clients about, that maybe this is a something that they should add to their portfolio as a risk return diversifier. Then we have large institutional investors like pensions, states, even countries talking about including cryptocurrencies as part of their investment portfolio. Another example is, right now, there are 64 publicly traded companies that have cryptocurrencies as part of their treasuries. That's something we see changing quite a bit as well. And all of that is very much at the front end right now.
Barbara agreed, basically.
It's quite interesting that such a big financial innovation has historically been driven by retail investors. I think this might be the only one or one of the exceptions where this has happened. And the crypto community has been speaking about institutionalization and institutional adoption for many years. We've seen a big shift. In terms of institutional adoption, I would actually divide this into two different layers. There's, on the one hand, the integration of cryptocurrencies in the product and service portfolio of institutional market participants. And so there's exchanges, there's banks, there's custodians, there's asset managers, right? And we've seen that for the last couple of years. And I think last year has been an accelerator. And next year probably will be too, especially given the recent anticipated regulatory changes in the US, for example. So I think that institutional adoption has been well advanced and is on track really to you know, just establish cryptocurrencies as just another service offering for these institutional market participants. It's really driven by these market participants believing that digital assets, cryptocurrencies are here to stay, that there is demand and that they want to provide access to this young and new asset class. A couple of weeks ago, there was big news on an unnamed UK pension fund that had started to invest into Bitcoin, certain corporates that are thinking about adding crypto to their treasury. But these are still a lot of singular examples that we are speaking about, right? That I think a lot of the volume that we see, be it via ETPs or via spot exposure, is still by a lot of either crypto native investors or by retail investors.
Then the question is, why? Why have institutional investors been skeptical? And why has that started to change?
I think there's a couple of different enablers, right? There's one regulation, right? So for example, as an asset manager, we have certain fund products where we are allowed to invest into crypto, certain fund products where we are not allowed to invest into crypto, right? And same for many institutional market participants. Some can invest, others cannot. Then there's this access question, right? Now there's increasingly ETPs available, very competitive ETPs as well across the globe, making access easier. If I want to invest spot, I might have to integrate with new service providers like a new crypto custodian. That might be quite a big of investment and initial work for maybe a small allocation initially. Education is a big topic. So our institutional investors are asking us, how do I value Bitcoin, right? What's a fair price of Bitcoin? How should I justify that in front of my investment committee? There's questions on how does cryptocurrencies relate to macroeconomic developments, right? So a lot of just experience building, understanding the fundamentals of the asset class, and then also the price drivers. And then there's also a question for these investors on how to handle the crypto-related risks. How do you handle the volatility? How do you handle the counterparty risk? How do you handle blockchain-specific tech risks? I think the journey of educating themselves about these factors and easing these factors is certainly accelerating. We do see more and more positive news about certain institutional investor groups in starting to invest, starting to look at this. But today, our impression is that it's still a lot of retail investors nonetheless.
At this point in the program, I need to issue an apology. Despite our acknowledging that digital assets are much more than cryptocurrencies, that's pretty much all we've been talking about. So let's take this opportunity to widen the discussion and talk about some of the other gaps that digital assets and the underlying technology have the potential to fill.
Names like Ethereum and Solana are one lever. So that's the platforms that enable a lot of solutions. And those, unlike stores of value like digital gold, they are businesses that aim to generate fees. So Ethereum and Solana, for example, are generating $4 billion in fees, which is very, very different than the perception of the space where there's not really traditional metrics that you can evaluate. These businesses then support a lot of applications, and those applications range from age-old things like money transfers and payments and newer things like AI and how do we deal with it. So, for example, in the payment sphere, right now the World Bank says on average, if you wanted to send $200 from point A to point B, the average cost is about 6.5%. Cryptocurrencies and blockchains can do that for almost negligible cost almost immediately. So you're starting to see $200 billion in stable coins that are being transacted. So in December alone, there was about $5 trillion worth of transfers that can happen. So that's one end, and the spectrum continues from there to disintermediating a large number of swaths like lending, borrowing, all the way on to newer problems and newer solutions.
It all sounds very, very promising, very exciting. If I'm an investor, though, how do I go about evaluating these opportunities? How do I find, separate the wheat from the chaff, let's say?
That very problem was meaningfully tougher, say, 4 or 5 or 6 years ago. What has changed about the space is there are so many things that are doing actual revenues and earnings and economic activity that can be monitored And by the way, that have been stress tested through a whole lot of volatility over the last couple of years, that you can now start applying traditional metrics to the space. So, for example, if you were to look at lending and borrowing as a vertical, right now there's $51 billion in value locked into lending and borrowing solutions on chain. These are collateralized and uncollateralized lending and borrowing solutions where you can access capital around the world very quickly and very cheaply, relatively speaking. And these are pure algorithmic systems where there is a system that lends and borrows and takes a margin in the middle. Similarly for trading businesses. So now very, very traditional models, just the underlying technology is such that it is available globally, it is available 24/7, and you can do it with far fewer people and far more scalability than in the traditional world.
This tokenization, that is, the digital representation of value on a blockchain, can apply to any type of asset. It opens up a lot of possibilities, and that's one reason that Barbara referred to tokenization as
the key use case. Why people are interested in it is to utilize benefits from the blockchain technology, right? By having a common technical infrastructure among market participants, they hope to realize operational efficiencies, right? They hope to reduce reconciliation issues across the fragmented value chains. They hope to increase transparency, increase settlement speed. They hope to automate processes through the programmability of tokens through the use of smart contracts. If you look at the various consultancy companies, they've all put forward predictions on, you know, multi-trillion dollar market growth expectations for tokenization and digital assets in the next few years. But then if you look at adoption today, there's very important singular use cases by, you know, very highly regarded institutions that have tokenized specific asset classes, but adoption and scalability of these use cases has been lagging behind expectations. I think there's three key factors that need to come together to enable that topic. And the issue is that all of these factors need to come at the same time and depend on each other. And those factors are regulation, technology, and then again, broad ecosystem adoption across the value chain. And if we just step through them one by one, I think regulation, especially in Europe, you have different national regulators that have been looking at the topic. For example, here in Germany, in Luxembourg, we have an EU pilot regime looking at it. So I think a lot of groundwork has been made by the regulator. There might be practical questions of applying those regulations and putting them into place, but a lot of groundwork has been made. Then I think there's some technology questions. Blockchain technology is a relatively young technology. It has a 16-year track record with Bitcoin. But there is questions on, for example, scalability, on security, on interoperability. And then there's ecosystem adoption, right? If we as DWS, for example, wanted to tokenize our funds and in future an investor can buy the Xtrackers token instead of the Xtrackers fund unit, then it's not just up to us to decide that, right? But the fund value chain is quite fragmented and all of the participants need to adopt and adhere to this new technology, need to understand it, need to be willing to put up the innovation costs. And I think the good news here in terms of ecosystem adoption is that crypto, in my opinion, lays a lot of groundwork. If, for example, a custodian looks at cryptocurrency custody, they can also custody a tokenized assets in principle from a technical standpoint. From a regulatory standpoint, it's, of course, different. The issue now with broader adoption is that there's a lot of innovation costs in the beginning that early adopters have to put out. And then many of these benefits that we've mentioned before, they will crystallize only or largely when there's large-scale adoption. So initially there's, you know, two parallel system, the blockchain-based system and the traditional financial system that you will operate in parallel. There's initial innovation costs, there's uncertainties on timeline adoption, how exactly tokenization will be adopted.
As the father of a 16-year-old, I will tell you that judging anyone or anything based on how it is on their 16th birthday may not be entirely fair. But what we heard from our guests was that despite existing roadblocks, skepticism, and just plain ignorance in some cases, the potential for digital assets for investors globally is very real.
What's exciting for me as an investor is that I now can look at a number of projects that are generating hundreds of millions and billions in fees and invest in those, and they are all very nascent still. So they have a long runway to go. And then I can invest in some far more nascent ideas in a liquid way that could be transformative. One area, for example, that is super exciting right now is the intersection of crypto and AI. And the idea is, well, AI is going to be transformative. Do we want it controlled by a handful of people? Or does it make sense to kind of make a lot of people have access to it and create a large number of solutions? And where crypto comes in, for example, getting compute capacity for running an AI system is very, very difficult. A small handful of people like Microsoft or Google have the compute capacity. Crypto is democratizing that compute capacity through decentralized compute availability. Similarly, for data, depending on the entity, they're feeding their particular set of data into their AI systems, and depending on the input, the outputs are accordingly driven. Blockchain says we can do that in a decentralized way, different people using different data sets, and some very targeted data sets for targeting acts. And what we've seen is, so ELIZA is a framework for AI agents. That was globally the most downloaded and most starred GitHub repo in the world last month. So we're seeing a lot of activity there. But even the traditional world, there are so many industries that are getting disintermediated from everything from music to real estate, the day-to-day things, for example, like your California driver's license and car title. The DMV is putting that on chain. So you're going to see a lot more of the blockchain solutions coming into your day-to-day lives. And we're very excited about seeing a lot of that.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Pat McCarr, Barbara, and Shubin, and of course to all of you for listening. Next up on the program, what does 2025 have in store for commercial real estate investors? We break down the five trends to watch, and you have my solemn oath that I will try and keep the location, location, location jokes to a minimum. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.